Our third speaker this morning is Brother Jesse Adair. He's from the Hamilton Book Road, Ontario, Canada Ecclesia. The theme for Brother Jesse's classes this week is The Last King of Judah. And today's class is entitled The Given King. Brother Jesse.
The kingdom of Judah, it spanned 347 years. It touched parts of four centuries. It had 12 prophets speak and minister. The throne had 20 kings sit upon it. Now, of those 20 kings, 8 were good and 12 were evil. The longest reign was 55 years, the shortest, just 3 months, and the average was 17 years. The average age when a king began to reign was 22 years of age. But of all the places and the events and all the people that would come and that would go in the kingdom of Judah, there was only ever one throne. And there was only ever one king who would be its last. And what we are going to endeavor to do today in the subsequent 5 days is to look at that king, the last king of Judah. And this will be the story of Zedekiah. Now, on your Bible marking sheets, you will have lots of notes there so you don't have to scurry and write things down furiously into your margin so that it's burning rubber. Much of what you see on the screen will be there in the Bible marking sheets. And how we will endeavor to cover Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, will be in these 6 classes. The first, Zedekiah, the given king. We are going to look at what were the requirements for a king before he was to take up the kingly throne. Class 2, we will look at Zedekiah, the yoking king. What was the yoke that was placed upon Zedekiah as he came to take up this place of leadership? Class 3 is Zedekiah, the oathen king. What was the oath that he was asked to place upon not only he, but the rulers in Jerusalem that extended far and wide to all that lived in that city? Class 4, Zedekiah, the warden king. How did he come about to make a pivotal decision to put in ward God's holy prophet? Class 5, Zedekiah, the craven king. What was going to cause Zedekiah's heart and soul to melt and to be fearful? And finally, class 6, Zedekiah, the taken king. What was his final choice that had irrecoverable resolutions for not only himself, but for all that dwelt in Jerusalem? But the story of the last king of Judah actually begins with the first king of Israel. Now, I'd like you to turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 8, because this is where our story is going to begin as we look at Zedekiah, the given king. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 8, this is when the nation is going to actually receive their very first king. And we're going to look at what was sort of the context and the reasons for Israel asking for a king. And it's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now, it says in verse 4, 1 Samuel chapter 8, these are in the waning years of Samuel. It says in verse 4 of 1 Samuel 8, "Then all the elders of Israel, they gathered themselves together, and they came to Samuel unto Ramah. And they said unto Samuel," verse 5, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. So now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." And the first reason of 2 reasons that the nation was going to ask for a king is right there in verse 5, to judge us. Now, what does it mean to be a judge? They wanted someone who was going to rule civilly. They wanted civil matters to be determined by this judge. You know, it's not too hard to sort of appreciate that you have a civil matter, you want it to be resolved. I mean, just think about some of the things of which we have back in our homes. The water, it's not working. The electricity, it's not on. So you want things to be resolved civilly. Okay? So the first reason why they were going to ask for a king is there in verse 5, to judge them. And they wanted to have someone who was going to rule civilly. But the second reason they wanted to have a king is also in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 19. It said, nevertheless, verse 19, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, nay, but we will have a king over us. Verse 20, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so the second reason they wanted to have a king is not only did they want someone to rule civilly, verse 5, they wanted someone to fight militarily, verse 20. So the two reasons that they were going to ask for a king are these here in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Reason 1, they wanted a judge, and this was someone who would rule civilly. And this had to do with all of those who were inside the land of Israel. Because clearly any Israelite who wanted to have a matter settled, they would come and they would have it settled by this king. Those inside the land. And the second reason, reason 2, they wanted a captain. So this is someone to fight militarily. And obviously this would be centered around those outside the land. So you can well appreciate that when Israel came, they had perhaps thought about this. They had these reasons. They had reason 1, we need someone to help those inside the land, to be a judge. Reason 2, we need someone to lead our battles, to fight those outside the land. We need a captain. And these were the two reasons that they were going to come to Samuel to make requests to have a king. But how did this go over with Samuel? Verse 6 of 1 Samuel 8. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. And when it says in verse 7 that they had rejected God, not Samuel, that word rejected in verse 7, it means despised. And so when they thought about God as their king, they got to a place in their spiritual low where they actually despised God. Well, they didn't say it out loud necessarily, but in their heart of hearts. Verse 7, the word rejected means despised. And perhaps the reason why they despised God is because they could not see God. But they could see all the other nations around them. So what does that mean? That means that they lacked crucial faith. In fact, they actually let it slip a little bit as to some of these reasons that they wanted a king. Because you'll notice in verse 5 at the very end, they said this phrase, like all the nations. And in verse 20, like all the nations. It's worth coloring that, isn't it? Because that was really couched beneath their reasons. That happens, brothers and sisters. You have a discussion, you have a conversation, you have a meeting, and you end up finding that what you are hearing on the surface, reason 1, reason 2, reason 3, reason 4, but then the little slip comes out, and you start to realize actually reason 1, 2, and so on aren't really the reasons. There's something underneath the surface. And if you can't get to that, then how are you actually going to resolve anything? We've all been in situations just like that. It's important to actually get to the kernel of the issue, and God did. And it wasn't a very kind assessment. So what we've looked at here is the two reasons were thus. They wanted a judge, and they wanted a captain. But, unfortunately, verse 5 and 20, they wanted to be like all the nations around them. Now you just come forward just to 1 Samuel chapter 11. because the very first king that we learn about of the nations around them was anything but godly. These were the type of nations and the types of kings that were around the nation of Israel. 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. Then Nahash, the Ammonite, came up, and he encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, "We'll make a covenant with us, and we'll serve thee." And verse 2 says of 1 Samuel 11, "And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, 'On this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I might thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for a reproach upon Israel.'" Now Nahash, his name, it means a serpent. So the very first king that we learned of after 1 Samuel chapter 8, the very first king of all the nations is Nahash, and his name means a serpent. These were the nations that Israel wanted to be like. Someone who was being led by a serpent. And what did this serpent king wanted to do to the nation of Israel? He said, "A covenant? Oh, sure." Verse 2, "Then I get all your right eyes." Now you have to ask yourself, why would Nahash do this? Was he a sadist? Probably. But you see, if you took out the right eye, what could you not do? You could not fight in the military. So if you had some sort of shield on the left and a sword on the right, and you covered up the left side of your face, oh, guess what? Now you're blind. So what Nahash was really saying was, "Hey, I'll take your right eye because then I will render you powerless." No such thing as a military who can only see out of one eye, particularly the left. And this is how the kings of the nations treated those that they conquered. They made them blind. In fact, a few comments here from the story of the Bible. This is from H.P. Mansfield's Volume 2, page 310 to 311. He says about this incident here in 1 Samuel 11, "The Ammonites, under Nahash, whose name means serpent, invaded the land east of Jordan and besieged the town of Jabesh-Gilead. And when they heard that he, Nahash, required, they were appalled. His terms of peace were that all the men of Jabesh submit to having their right eyes thrust out as an insult to all Israel, showing that they had left their brethren to the fate of the enemy. The soldier, using his shield with his left hand, hides his left eye and requires his right eye for sight. Nahash's terms would have destroyed all the men of Jabesh as fighting units." But you see, if Israel was to have a king over them, who would act as a judge and a captain, you couldn't be like this king. You couldn't be like Nahash. You couldn't be like the nations and the kings around them. You had to be someone completely different. You couldn't have serpent thinking on the throne. You had to have godly thinking. And the requirements for what that king was to do, if you come with me to Deuteronomy chapter 17, are found. And they were the first priority. Because when you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 17, these are the qualifications for what a king was to do, and they were not to be done later on. They were to be the first priority for all kings when they took up the throne in Israel. And there were many qualifications for a king. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 17, it begins this way, this little section in verse 14. "When thou art come unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are round about me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set a king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brethren." Now you would have probably noticed that there's a few qualifications right here in verse 14 and 15. Firstly, if they were going to have a king, he had to be an Israelite. They were not permitted to have someone who was not of the house of Israel. And that's important because therefore that king would believe in the hope of Israel. And it was especially important because you will notice, maybe you circle them, in verse 14 and 15, this phrase that was mentioned four times, "over thee." You see in verse 14, I will set a king over me. Verse 15, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee. Second time. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee, and he would not be a stranger. Verse 15, over thee, that is not thy brother. So four times, one in verse 14 and three in verse 15, this king was going to be over Israel. This was going to be an incredible responsibility, because all who lived in Israel were going to be beholden to the decisions that this king made. Now, brothers and sisters, it is not difficult for us in this day and age to well and truly appreciate the impact of one man who is over many. And the decisions that one man can make that will have lasting and deep ramifications. But that's what Israel was choosing. They wanted that. They asked for it. They wanted to have a judge, and they wanted to have a captain. But God said, he will be over thee, and his decisions will have a direct impact on you. And so the choices and the actions that this one king who was over the people was going to impact the entire kingdom. So it was going to be good that there was things which this king was not to do. Now, I suggest it's good to break down this little section here of verse 16 and 17, that these are going to be things the king should not do. So verse 16 you'll see, verse 17 you'll see, this is what the king should not do. But by extension, verse 18 to 20, the balance of the chapter, that's what the king is to do. So let's look at what the king was not to do, verse 16. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord has said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. And neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. And neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Now, there were three things that the king was not to do. And how do we know that? Because there's this word that comes up. It's the word multiply. So you notice in verse 16, the king was not to multiply his horses by any avenue. And then in verse 17, neither was he to multiply his wives. And also in verse 17, neither was he to multiply his silver and his gold. But it's important to sort of put that into our perspective of, like, what could we sort of say that is in other words, okay? So here is a suggestion for you. This is what the king was not to do. He was not to multiply three things in his kingdom. Firstly, he was not to multiply his horses. And that would be multiplying his military. Because why else would you want those tried and tested stallions and horses coming through to multiply his military? He was not to multiply his wives. And that clearly is to multiply his marriages. To find ways to have certain alliances, or to maybe have his own profitable things in his hand. And finally, he was not to multiply silver and gold. That means he was not to multiply his money. So these are the three things that the king was not to do. He was not to multiply his military, he was not to multiply his marriages, and he was not to multiply his money. Well, it would be quite sad if the king said, well, the chapter just finished there, and I kind of ended on a dour note. So what am I supposed to do? Well, here's what he was supposed to do in verse 18 to 20. So he has also found out that he's not to do these three things, but he is to do these things. And they're found here in verses 18 to 20. And here's what he was to do in verse 18. And it shall be that when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. Now, verse 18 is telling us that the most important thing a king was to do was to have a personal knowledge of God's law. A personal knowledge of God's law. Now, I mentioned I was a Pentecostal, and going back, boy, some of these pastors, they could really just spin the yarn. They were amazing. But you know what was so sad about it? Was we had this, almost like a mega church, not the size of ones in Texas or anything. I don't want to step on their toes. But it was a mega church. Like, we had 2,000 people at it. Six pastors, head pastor, youth pastor, music pastor, the list goes on. And boy, could they talk. Oh, they can make you go out there and you think, whew, what did I just take? I can't wait to get some more of that. And you know what happened? Throughout the middle of the week, they had no personal knowledge of the Bible. So what you find is that people live like a yo-yo. It's up on Sunday, and then down, 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 up on Sunday, and then down, down, up on Sunday. And you can't live like that, brothers and sisters. We know that. And what makes our community so special and so unique is that individually we are like the kings in preparation, as it were. We have a personal knowledge of God's law. And that is what this king was to do. It was to be a top priority for a young man. And how young? Well, if the average age of these kings that were going to sit on this throne was 22 years old, that's young. And that personal knowledge of God's law was going to endeavor to help them and set a foundation when they were young to build off the rest of their life. And the king, notice, they had to, verse 18, copy out the law. They had to pick up the quill or the pen or whatever writing instrument they used at that time, and they had to copy it. Now, that's important because I think we'll probably understand this and it'll resonate with us, but, our memories are quite fickle, brothers and sisters. So if we want to try and endeavor to do things that will help us with best memory, well, there's different things that we can do. So, by and large, 10% of what we read, we remember. It's not that great, 10%, okay? 20% of what we hear, we remember. 30% of what we see, we remember. 75% of what we write, we remember. Now, don't look at your Bible marking sheets, because I'm pretty certain I put this on there, but in your head, take a guess, there's one more, and it's at 90%. But if we want to have our memory as astute as possible, then what should we do that will give us a 90%, hopefully, retention rate? It's to teach. So when this king sat upon this throne, and he was going to write down the law of God, he was going to have a 75% chance to actually remember that law. And because every day he was going to be involved in civil matters and judging, etc., then he would perhaps have to be teaching. So this king, if he was acting according to Deuteronomy 17, would have the best preparation possible for him to remember. And just a further extension, when we are doing classes or looking after the young people or something like that, there's something to consider that there's two sort of types of teaching methods. And the gray on the left is the passive teaching. And that involves things like lectures or just reading or maybe a few audio visuals, maybe a demonstration, but they're more passive. The audience is sort of like on the receiving side of these things. But the participatory teaching method involves things like discussion groups, practiced by maybe doing or some application, or taking a principle, digesting it, and then teaching it to others. Okay? And we know this, but it's just helpful because I know a number of us have volunteered our time to do that, particularly young people, and it's sort of like there are methods, but maybe if we're looking for higher success, we go to other methods. Okay? Now, the king was going to have to take up a certain spirit if he was going to teach the nation. I want you to hold something in Deuteronomy 17 and just come with me to Malachi chapter 2. Because not only was this king supposed to write down his personal copy of the law, by doing that, he would endeavor to take up a certain spirit. And here's what we find in Malachi chapter 2 about that spirit. Malachi chapter 2. So never do we ever want to just say, well, I got the personal copy of the law, I'm all set. Yeah, but you got to match it with the spirit. And here's the spirit that hopefully the king would have found in Malachi chapter 2, taking up the spirit of the Levites. There's a verse 4 of Malachi 2. Here's what it says. Ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. For my covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them to him for a fear, wherewith he feared me, and was afraid before my name. And you notice in verse 5 of Malachi chapter 2, that the spirit of Levi, it is anchored in fearing God and not anything else. And that fear, that godly fear, it will produce something which is long-lasting and abiding. So the king was not to fear man because he was to know the law of God, and that law was to produce in that king a fear of God. And the outcome of that fear, verse 6 of Malachi chapter 2, the law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn many away from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. And so if the law of the truth was in the king's lips, as it was in the priests, the Levites, then the law of truth would go forth from the king's throne. And all the decisions that the king would make would have the best chance of a godly outcome. And so, this king was to endeavor to make it a godly throne with godly actions once he had written down the law of God. Now come back with me to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Because what we notice also is that this king was to be a man of action. Okay? He had to not only have a personal copy of the law, but he had to actually put it into application. And you might have these circled. If you don't, I encourage you. But in verse 18 and 19, just notice the verbs that pertain to the king as he took his throne. Verse 18 of Deuteronomy 17. It shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom that, one, he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests of Levites. So first thing, he had to actually participate by writing. Verse 19, and it shall be with him, and he shall read therein. So not only did he have to write, verse 18 of Deuteronomy 17, but he had to read it, verse 19. And he was going to read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. So you circle these words, you start to understand that if we are going to be kings in training for the kingdom, leaders as it were, then we need to learn. Because we've read, and we endeavor to keep, and we do these things. All of these are going to make up a godly leader, and in Israel's case, a godly king. And you had to do it, verse 19, all the days. There's no day off. So we have to make sure that in our heart of hearts, that we are making sure that each day that we are granted, that we are actually living for God in the capacity that he is asking us to live. No days off. You couldn't do that if you're a king, because there was a steep warning at the end of this chapter in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 20. And here is the warning, verse 20. He had to not do certain things, he had to do others, because this was the impact that only the king was going to have. Only the king. Verse 20 of Deuteronomy 17. And notice the phrase, that. Verse 20. That his heart be not lifted up above his brethren. That he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left. And that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Now, those three warnings in verse 20, I'm going to suggest to you how they might impact different parties in Israel. Okay? So the king's choices carried with them serious impacts. That his heart be not lifted up above his brethren. This clearly had a direct impact on his brethren. That's what it says. So if the king had a proud heart, this was definitely going to impact his brethren. Secondly, that he turned not aside from the commandment. This was going to have a direct impact on himself and his personal decision making. And finally, that he may prolong his days, he and his children. This was going to have a direct impact on his family. I mean, really, brothers and sisters, can you think of another important group where the law of God is saying that depending on your circumstances and decisions, these are the impacts you're going to have? Like, if you do, you come up afterwards and we'll have a chat about it. I'd love to hear about it. But really, our decisions are going to have direct impacts on our brethren. Clearly, our decisions are going to have a direct impact on the consequences that we have to bear. And our decisions are going to have an impact on our families. And the king was told that this is what you are to do because it comes with a warning. But if he cherished the law of God and he was careful and he applied it carefully, things would go well for him. It says, the law here given to the prince, the king, that he should be elected for due administration of the government. One, he must carefully avoid everything that would divert him from God and religion. Riches, honor, pleasures, all of these three great hindrances of godliness. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life summarized. Especially to those in high stations. Against these, therefore, the king is to be warned. Number two, he must carefully apply himself to the law of God and make it his rule. This must be to him better than all riches, honors, and pleasures, than many horses or many wives, better than thousands of gold and silver. For firstly, his writing and the reading must possess him with very reverent and awful regard to the divine majesty and authority. Secondly, it must engage him to a constant observance of the law of God and a conscientious obedience to it as the effect of that fear. And thirdly, it must keep him humble. How much soever he is advanced, let him keep his spirit low. Let the fear of his God prevent the contempt of his brethren. The Bethany Parallel Commentary of the Old Testament, Matthew Henry, page 358. Brothers and sisters, if this king was to keep a copy of the law, if he was to read it every day, he would learn to fear the Lord. And he would have no time to multiply his money, no time to multiply his marriages, and no time to multiply his military. And that was going to be particularly important because when you come with me to 2 Kings chapter 23, these are the very things that King Nebuchadnezzar diminished when Zedekiah took the throne. Because Zedekiah took the throne in a very tumultuous time. It was not a time of peace or splendor. It was a time of uncertainty and of the nations rising up around, thinking that they could defy that of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Because 2 Kings chapter 23, it says in verse 31, giving us an idea of the time of which Zedekiah was going to come into the throne, verse 31 of 2 Kings 23, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. And Pharaoh Necho put him in bands at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in his room of Josiah his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim, and took Jehoahaz away. And he came to Egypt, and he died there. Now what you notice in verse 33 is that there is a diminishing of money in verse 33 at the very end, because there was a tribute to be paid and 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. So what we might write next to verse 33 is that there is a diminishing of this money that is available in this kingdom as Zedekiah is in the shadow of taking the throne. And furthermore, to this money, you notice in verse 35, so what does Jehoiakim do? Well, verse 35 of 2 Kings 23, he gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh. And he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. And he exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land. So no one else in this kingdom was going to have any money either, because the people were going to sort of be extorted from it. And so the diminishing of this kingdom came with the diminishing of the money supply when Zedekiah was in the shadow of taking the throne. So firstly, we find out that the money in the kingdom is nowhere to be found. Okay? Now, if you come into 2 Kings chapter 24, we're also going to find out that not only is the money being diminished, but the marriages that might be available are also going to be diminished as well. Okay? So here's what we find. Verse 16 of 2 Kings 24. All the men of might, even 7,000, craftsmen, smiths, 1,000, all that were strong and apt for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. And the king of Babylon made Mattani, his father's brother, king in his stead, and changed his name to Zedekiah. So in verse 16 of 2 Kings chapter 24, what do you notice? All the men of might, apt for war, in verse 16, they were brought to Babylon. So if you're Zedekiah and you're going to take the throne, not only is the land poor, it's got no money, but in 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 16, it's got no men to fight in the military. Or if there are men, they're not the strongest ones, not the ones that were apt for war, the thousands of them, they've been carried to Babylon. So what we find so far is that the money has vacated this kingdom. We also find that the men of war have vacated this kingdom. But thirdly, notice in verse 14 of 2 Kings chapter 24, it says that Nebuchadnezzar carried away all Jerusalem, all the princes, all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and smiths, none remained save the poorest of the people of the land. And notice what it says in verse 15. And he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon, the king's mother, the king's wives. His officers, the mighty of the land, those carried he into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And so what you find in verse 14 and 15 of 2 Kings 24 is that the king's mother has been taken, all the king's wives have been taken. And so there is a diminishing not only of the money and of the military, but also of the marriages of which Zedekiah might have at his disposal. So these three things have been diminished. Nebuchadnezzar has diminished the king's treasures. He diminished his money. Nebuchadnezzar has diminished the king's wives. He's diminished his marriages. And Nebuchadnezzar has diminished the king's men of might. He has diminished his military. So when you are Zedekiah and you are coming onto the throne, you have this urge to multiply what has been diminished. Or you could put that urge down and lift up the law of God that said you ought not to strengthen them. And what's more, brothers and sisters, is in verse 17 of 2 Kings 24, Nebuchadnezzar has diminished your money, your marriages, and your military. And to show a complete and utter dominance upon you, he's changed your name. Because in verse 17 of 2 Kings 24, and the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead, and he changed his name to Zedekiah. Now, I don't know about you, brothers and sisters, but those of us who are parents in this room, it is the honor of parents to put upon a child a name. It shows a right and proper responsibility, but it shows a level of authority that that child will have to learn. Zedekiah is not a child. He is in the prime of his days. He is about to take the throne that has no money, no military, no marriages. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I am over you. This is Zedekiah. But in our next class tomorrow, God is going to put something upon Zedekiah. And Zedekiah is going to have to choose whether or not he bears it upon his shoulders. What that thing is, we'll look at when we consider our second class, Zedekiah, the Yoken King.